Hi, everybody. Welcome to part three of my Favorites of 09 series of podcasts featuring the Gamers Confab. In this episode, I'm joined by Manveer Hare, game designer at Raven Software and author of the Design Rampage blog, Mitch Kropata, who reviews games for the Boston Phoenix and Paste magazine. He also writes Insult Sword Fighting, one of the premier gaming blogs on the net. And I'm happy to welcome a new member of the Confab, Tom Bissell, who's written for Harper's Magazine, The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other publications. He's also the author of four books, including the forthcoming Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter, which will be published in June. My thanks to all three guests for joining me. I invite you to check out the previous two episodes, as well as a final one, which will appear in a couple of days. They're available on my website and also via iTunes. So, thanks for listening, and away we go. Well, I want to welcome Manveer Hare and Mitch Kropata to the podcast. We're kind of keeping our eye out for Tom Bissell. He was scheduled to join us, and I expect he may still pop in. So if he does, I'll add him to our conversation. But for now, we'll get the conversation going with Manveer and Mitch. And guys, welcome back. It's great to have you back on the podcast.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Well, you guys know the drill. This is our favorite game of 2009 chat. And Mitch, would you like to start us off?
Sure, I would love to start you off. Let's see, how much suspense should I try to get people in since I've already said what my favorite game of the year is in a couple of different places? I'll just go for it. My favorite game this year was Borderlands, which was the World of Warcraft first-person shooter hybrid. And I've actually was just playing it again today for several hours without really realizing the time was passing. There's a lot I'd say about it, and I'll probably say more, but I'll say as far as when you talk about figuring out what's the best game you played and what's your favorite game that you played this year, I wouldn't have thought that Borderlands was my favorite game when I was initially playing it until I realized that I was still playing it weeks and months later, that I'd be reviewing something else. I'd be like, if I can finish this up, you know, before 10 o'clock, I can get into Borderlands, I can level up another time. So that's... Every year it seems there's some game that you just keep playing, and for me this year it was definitely that one.
What is it about that game that, I mean, it seems like a lot of us took that game kind of at face value, and you've written about it and talked about it a little bit as sort of like that's kind of a mistake, that there's more there than meets the eye.
Well, it may be that there is, but it's, you know, it's not the sort of game that lends itself to much deep scrutiny either. I mean, it is almost purely play. It's all about leveling up, and once you end the game, you can just start over right away with your same character, and all the enemies are tougher and you get more experience points. So it's sort of purely play, I guess you could say. It's purely ludic, if you wanted to use the terminology, which is something I don't usually think I want from a game, and yet 2 years in a row now, when the year has ended, I've said to myself, you know, the game that I kept playing was the one that I just played. I didn't think about it. I didn't get necessarily emotionally invested in it, although to some degree I did because of the multiplayer. But it is the kind of game that you just play, and you play it for as long as you want or as short as you want. You do as much or as little as you want in a given session, and it always gives you exactly what you came for.
Yeah. Does the game have a lineage to you? I mean, does it seem like it comes out of other games that it's clearly influenced by? I mean, you mentioned World of Warcraft, obviously.
Yeah, and I actually have never played World of Warcraft, but I think after playing this game, I understand why so many people like it. It follows a similar mission structure. Apparently, this is what people tell me, where you'll have numerous missions going at the same time. That'll be, you know, you can finish them up, but you haven't turned them in yet, that sort of a thing. But it plays a lot like Halo, which is also a game that I have not liked very much in the past. And I guess the developer is Gearbox. They did the PC port of Halo. And you can sort of tell that they just probably recycled some of their assets for it. There's a vehicle that you drive in this game that controls like the Warthog. I mean, exactly like the Warthog. So you start playing it and you say, oh, I know exactly what this is. You know, this feels exactly right to me. But then you start sort of stacking the other kinds of games there that it's ripping off together. And when it's all said and done, it is very much its own thing, but you could take any piece of it apart and say, well, this comes from somewhere else. I know where this came from.
Yeah. Does it feel more like a shooter or more like an RPG?
Definitely feels like a shooter. I mean, they nailed that. I wouldn't know exactly what words to use for it, except to say that it feels exactly right. I mean, when you're aiming, when you're firing, you get, you know, you got several different kinds of guns. You got your standard issue sniper rifle, combat rifle, all these things. It always feels right. You always, if you're a shooter fan, you don't have to learn anything new to play this game. The RPG stuff is definitely built on top of the shooting and not the other way around.
Yeah. Have you played this, Manveer?
Yeah, I actually just beat it last week. I played through it with my buddy. I didn't play the DLC yet, but we went through it. We did like every single mission that we could find. It was his third playthrough, but I had never played through, so it was all new for me. Yeah. I really enjoyed the game. I didn't love it as much as Mitch did. I found the core shooting game loop, like of combat, just not to be engaging enough to hold me for long periods of time. And I think I'm in the minority here, because I would go to work and my friends would be like, well, we were up till 2 a.m. playing this like for 6 hours straight. And I was like, I got sick of it after 2.5 hours. But it was a game that I could consistently come back to and play for like 2 or 3 hours at a time. I just couldn't ever get into it for longer periods than that, which honestly, like, that's kind of a really nitpicking thing, because how many games can you play for just like super, super long periods of time?
I would say that I definitely see where you're coming from. If I play this game single player, especially, there are parts where they just start throwing enemies at you, and I'm just trying to get to where my mission objective is, and I'm standing there and they're spawning, and I'm like, I'm just trying to get something done. But when I play with other people, which is how I played most of the time, it completely changes it to me. Then I'm happy that these things are happening, because the way that you bounce off the other players is really remarkable in a lot of ways. I mean, half of the interesting things you can do in this game will only work when you have other people in your party.
Right.
I keep beating this drum, but I thought it was so great, and I don't know if other games have done it. They probably have, but I had never seen it before. A guy that I played with most of the time developed his soldier as a medic, and so by shooting me, he would heal me. And I still haven't gotten tired of this. I think it's just an amazing thing. You go running into combat, and every time your health starts flagging, he just runs up to you with a shotgun and blasts you in the face, and you're fine. And it's just so funny, and it's that kind of a thing. You know, it's, like I say, purely play, purely silly, and it never got tired of it. And every time, everything you do, everything you sort of build up for your character track does things like that. And if you're playing single player, you're never going to know that you're missing out on, I would say, much more than half the game.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I always played with one other guy, and I had a good time with that. So for me, what I noticed playing the game was, I think the game is all about loot and like collecting and getting upgraded equipment, which like works, right? Diablo has proven that whole style works and it's fun. But I don't think I'm personally as invested in that as I am into like story and narrative and building. Like, I loved building my character. I had the berserker, and I loved, like, you know, choosing what stats I was upgrading and like going down a certain path. Like, that was all fun, but the actual loot itself didn't excite me as much. So like, once I got like 7 hours into the game, you pretty much have experienced the game as a whole. I mean, there's a handful of bosses later, but they don't add a whole lot. There's just a handful of new enemies. But really, you're just playing the same thing over and over, just with newer weapons that do more awesome killings.
Yeah.
So for me, that started, it didn't fall flat. It dove off earlier than I think it did for most people. And that's where also I played it like 11 hours one day to finish it off. So I think that didn't really help, that I just like slogged through it. Like, my first day of like winter vacation with my buddy, I was like, let's beat this game today. I need to move on and play other games. And we just slogged through it for like 11 hours. And I mean, I had a good time, but it was, at the end of it, I was like, yeah, let's play the DLC in a couple weeks. Like, I need a break before I come back to this.
Mitch, I haven't played the game, but I remember reading that it's got some sort of procedural process for creating like weapons and item drops and stuff. Does that emerge in any way as special or different?
Yeah, you know, it does and it doesn't. I mean, all the weapons have various characteristics, and my understanding is that they're randomly generated, and, you know, the strength of them is based on what level you're at for the most part. And there are different things, and you will occasionally find some really rare thing that blows your mind. Although it is actually kind of true that they're not as different as you might be led to believe when you read the marketing that says, you know, millions of unique guns. It's like, well, no, it's millions of just barely different guns. But it is still really fun, the kinds of things you come across. You know, you'll have elemental effects, for example. So, you know, you might have a sniper rifle that will set people on fire. You know, you have a shotgun that fires rockets out. So, you know, you get some really crazy things. They are pretty fun. It is a little bit overblown as to how much variety there is, but it does, you know, they continue to strengthen along with your character. And so what's kind of funny is that you'll hang on to a weapon for way too long because you loved it, and suddenly you realize you've basically got a pea shooter at this point, which used to seem, you know, practically nuclear to you. So you have to sort of, you have to turn on your weapons on a dime. You got to be ready to just sell them off and take whatever's new because there's always something better coming.
Yeah, what I noticed happened was, like, what was awesome at the beginning of the game is, like, you were changing weapons constantly. Like, you're finding a new, better weapon, and it's just that, like, you know, constant, like, feedback loop of new stuff, new stuff, new stuff. Towards, like, the last end of the game, I don't know if it was just my random drops sucked or I had gotten such a cool, awesome weapon earlier that nothing, like, overcame it. But, like, I was using a shotgun, and it had a scope on it, and it was corrosive, and, like, that would just, like, melt enemies away. And, like, that just became the uber weapon. And, unfortunately, like, I would never find anything better than that, and I never did for me. So, like, the last 5 hours of the game, I kind of played with the same gun the entire time. And so, like, all that cool stuff that you were getting kind of went away at that point. And then, so now the loot and the experience points don't matter nearly as much. And that was a little, I think the ending, the amount of loot that they were, like, ramping you up to, like, epic loot or unique loot at the end could have been a little better. But for, like, the first, like, you know, 15 hours of the game, like, you're just always upgrading your stuff and it's awesome. You're like, oh, sweet, new fire effect.
I feel like it's come around again, actually. I'm fairly deep into my second playthrough, and you're right, I hit that same sort of plateau where I was like, I'm just using the same things. This isn't really getting better. And I feel like lately they have been. I keep finding, you know, legendary stuff at a much higher rate than I used to, and I'm getting pretty interesting things. And, you know, just even things like shields and class mods and all these things. You're not just finding weapons. You're finding a ton of different items that affect the way you play the game. And what's really fun is trying to combine those all in different ways.
One of the things that everybody sort of talked about with that game is it's obviously got kind of a throwaway plot. There's, you know, it's just kind of hung on there. I guess it's a question for both of you, but, like, why do we need plots? I mean, I just take it as a given that if you're going to do a shooter, you have to have a plot and you have to have characters. It seems like we've basically agreed that that's fundamental necessities of game design. But, like, when it's obviously just an afterthought or it just doesn't seem to matter, like, it sort of raises the question, why do we need them?
Well, for me personally, at least, it's like it's the same reason why when we're kids, we play cowboys and Indians. Like, we want at least some reference set of, like, why we're doing our actions or something to role play or something to, like, hang our hat on. I feel like man is like, meant to tell stories in some way. Now, whether they're just, like, fully linear stories or, you know, interactive stories, that's a whole different ballpark, but I personally, I'm really invested, even in, like, bad games, like games that I know are going to have bad stories. I still care enough about the story that I want it to be at least somewhat serviceable. And so for me on Borderlands, that actually did hurt it a little bit. Like, I didn't ding it huge because of that, because it's not what it's all about. But at the same time, had it had something that I was more interested in doing, had it been easy to follow, even, like, it's really, like, honestly, it felt like it was thrown in there for, like, just at the last second or kind of just slogged together. Had it been, like, more cohesive and I felt like, oh, I know why I'm fighting against this boss now, I would have been a little more invested in their universe, because really what they've just created is a universe. And that's important for an IP, original IP, if they're going to try to keep monetizing this game, you know, over sequels and everything. That's like what Halo built was a universe. And so if you want to, like, match that, I think you need to be able to tell a decent story there. At least.
Well, I mean, certainly not only is the story in Borderlands threadbare, but in the course of playing it, we realized we even missed what little there was. You know, you get little sort of radio messages from people, and we suddenly realized about 35 hours into the game, we're like, oh, what are we? We're trying to open a vault? Is that? Oh, I missed that. You know, and that's the story. The story is find the pieces of the key and open the vault. And there's nothing more to it. And we even missed that. But, you know, I would have to say, I mean, you know, if you if you ask me what is, build your ideal game out of a vacuum, I would always say that a story is really important. I need a reason to care, and I want to be invested in characters or whatever. But what I am always surprised by with video games is how there isn't one thing that they need in order to be good. Borderlands doesn't really have a story, and it's still good because what I actually cared about was making my character stronger and finding loot and interacting in new and hilarious ways with the people I was playing it with. And that, not only was that good enough, but it was great. It was all I could have needed from Borderlands. And, Borderlands was the game I played immediately after Uncharted 2, which does have a good story. I mean, for a video game, it's maybe a great story. And they couldn't be any more different. And I would have thought when I played Uncharted that I just played the best game of the year. I played, the greatest thing I've seen all year. And then immediately afterward, I pick up this thing with no story, threadbare plot. It's just, sort of a grind in some ways. It's repetitive. And that was the game that I said, this is what I wanted from a video game in the year 2009. And I never would have expected it.
But even though that's true, you agree with Manveer that you at least, even a crappy story, you've at least got to have some thread that weaves its way through.
Yes, but, I'm before we started this call, I was sitting here playing Free Cell on my computer. And that doesn't have a story. You can't even fake one there. You could try to overthink something like Borderlands and say that you build the narrative with the people you play with. And you wouldn't necessarily be wrong, but you'd be kind of trying to justify something that doesn't need justification, I think.
Yeah. And to be clear, I'm not saying that all games need story. I don't want to anyone to think that that's how I feel. I just think I come, my background, playing games originated with adventure games and RPGs, and those are obviously a single player RPG, so very, very story heavy elements. And I think that's just what I personally like. I like being told stories or working with stories, interacting with stories. So that's just always been my personal preference. So when I look at something like Borderlands, I go, well, had it had a little better of a story, I would have liked it even more. I mean, I put that game, if we're doing ratings or whatever, I said an 8 out of 10. I had a good time with it. I got a lot of hours of play out of it, much more than most of the games I played this year. And that stuff's fantastic. And had it had that extra bit and didn't lose anything else because they had to develop that story, I think it would have been even better.
Yeah. I'm just curious, how does a person who designs a shooter game at Raven, with Raven's background, with sort of what Raven represents in terms of the history of shooters, how do you play somebody else's shooter? What's going through your mind when you're playing a shooter from another house?
Yeah, I think I've heard a lot of developers say this too. The worst thing about being a developer is you can't always enjoy games anymore, because you just start deconstructing games, and especially games that are similar to games that you're either working on or have worked on in the past. So you deconstruct, hey, how do the firing mechanics work? You look at the nuances of animation. I notice these really small animation glitches in Borderlands that pretty much every shooter ships with, and nobody would notice except for the people who made the game and other developers. So you play it that way. You try to turn your brain off sometimes and just go, I'm just trying to have fun. I'm playing with my buddy. But you also try to learn lessons. I think it's important to look at other games. Modern Warfare 2 even, you play that and you go, wow, they did that, and that. And I see why they did they built their scripting that way. And that's a really smart thing to do if you want to make, a tightly cohesive, scripted area. So I think it's just a game of deconstruction and appreciation, because, heck, even making bad games is hard. Making good games like Borderlands is even harder. I know some people on that team, and I know some of the it wasn't an easy path for them the entire time, because making games is never easy. And to know that they didn't have an easy time the entire way, and they came out with a really solid, good product that's definitely going to, I think the sequel is going to be great, because now they've just got this really strong foundation to fix all the small problems that they do have. That's kind of exciting too, because that gives me hope, hey, you can fix all those problems and you can learn your lessons and kind of move on from there.
Yeah. Very good. So your game is Borderlands. Manveer, let's talk about your game of 09.
Yeah, there's a lot of good games this year, and I know most of them got delayed till next year, and I just printed out all the games that are coming out the next few months, and it's scary with Mass Effect 2 and Heavy Rain and Splinter Cell Conviction and God of War 3, but there were still a lot of good games that came out this year. The game that stuck out at the end of the day for me that like literally as a developer made me cry because it's like you just stepped up, like you just made everyone's job harder, was Uncharted 2 Among Thieves. Mm-hmm. Like that game was absolutely phenomenal in every way for me. And what's scary and worrisome about it is it's not doing anything particularly new. It's just this incredibly highly polished game. Perfectly paced story, like great level design, great mechanics, fixed all the like problems that I had with Uncharted 1, which Uncharted 1 I played for the first time this summer. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. I just was like, oh, this is good, but not great. And Uncharted 2 just like blew me out of the water. Just the set pieces they have. I mean, the game starts and you're hanging off a train that's over a cliff. And like, you're immediately tense, but this is a tutorial. And they found this way to balance of like, learning how to climb things, and really you can't even die in that section, I don't think, but you still feel tension. And like, that's amazing. Like Naughty Dog, like I don't know how they pulled that off. I can't imagine how much time and iteration that took to get just perfectly right. There's lots of little touches in that game that really sell it. You know, if you're looking at a fire, like Drake will like cover his like eyes, like they got all these extra custom animations for that. The biggest problem I had with Uncharted 1 was the actual combat itself. Like, cover would just get destroyed all around you. Guys would flank you from both sides and, like, almost spawn behind you and shoot you in the face. And you'd die and throw the controller down and be like, this sucks. And Uncharted 2, they really fixed that problem. They built their spaces much better for combat. Your cover is a lot more permanent in most cases. It's not as destructible, which is actually a good thing. The guys don't try to flank you too much. They don't try to be too smart. They added in stealth if you want to opt in for the stealth. There's only one section of the game that requires stealth, and it's actually the worst part of the game, in my opinion, because it's like if you fail that stealth, it's a hard fail. You fail the level, you start over. Whereas everywhere else, if you fail the stealth, you just pull your gun out and shoot guys in the face. The game is just the set pieces and the storytelling. Again, you know, I'm a story guy, so like, you know, I'm a sucker for... It's not even an original story, frankly. Like it's all about chasing one MacGuffin the entire time. It's like, you know, there's one thing that's your object of your affection. You know how the game is going to play out for the most part. But the entire time you're invested in the characters, the performances are fantastic. I mean, I think Naughty Dog's revolutionizing the way cinematics are done for that type of game. And they're lucky being in LA. I could never do that in Wisconsin, for example. But, you know, getting the actors on and doing all that stuff, like, that's expensive and hard to do, but they're pulling it off and just, like, changing the way some games are made. Linear, story-driven games are made, I think. And they just took it to a new level. So for me, Uncharted 2 was just phenomenal. As a developer, it made me literally weep and, like, had my mouth open multiple times, like, holy crap, how did they pull that off? The train level, have you guys both played the game?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The train level is like, so most train levels, the train is going straight and it's just like the same like cartoon generated landscape going by you on both sides. And this one, it looks like it's actually on a track. And I think then they change the camera angle at certain times and they teleport it to a new track to make like make things still sync up, but look and feel awesome. And I know exactly how hard that is. No, I don't, because I tried to do that once, actually, during Wolfenstein, when way earlier we had a train level in development. And I was like, well, I don't want to have a straight train. I want it to actually feel like it's going through the area. So we'll have all these loops and circles. And I worked on that for about a month, and I realized how much work it was going to be. And then we cut it. They pulled it off. They pulled it off and then took it to a new level. And I was just like, holy hell. Like,
yeah.
That is ridiculous. Like, you can't do a train level again. Like, we've been at work, like, you know, joking. I'm like, if we ever do a train level, you have to do at Uncharted 2 level or surpass it. Like, yeah. That's the minimum now. You can't go backwards. It makes it harder for the rest of us, but I think that's good for the medium as a whole.
It's full of so many little things. I mean, you said that a few minutes ago. It's all these little things. The polish on the game, the unbelievably high level of polish, and all of the little things that sort of say quality, you know, the stuff that you don't even realize you're really processing, but in the theater, it's true as well. In film, it's true. It's little moments of polish that are either technical or that somehow maybe trigger an emotion that has just been done so well that it elevates what you're experiencing in kind of subtle ways that all together add up to something that isn't subtle at all. It's really significant.
Right.
The music in the game, and the instrumentation, the arrangements of the music, and the way they play with it. I mean, I had it in my head because I'd written a little bit about this, of sort of going back and really trying to analyze it. And I have a certain degree of musical chops, but not a lot. So I really need somebody like Dan Bruno or somebody to sit next to me and help me. But it's the way that in each scene they will reintroduce a motif, or they'll rearrange a piece and emphasize something that seems to go well with the setting that you're in. It's just full of that kind of stuff. Amazing.
And what's really interesting is, and again, I think this is stuff that only other developers notice, because like we pull up Uncharted all the time at work. I'm like literally, we'll be sitting there debating something, and like literally, someone will speak up and go, well, "Why don't we look at what Uncharted 2 did? Because let's at least use that as a baseline." Mm-hmm. And like, why did that work for their game? And you don't want to just copy another guy people's game, but there's no need to reinvent the wheel at times too. So you go, "Well, let's see how they did it and start there." And you pull the game up. And you can find all these pieces of unpolished stuff too, actually. You can find low resolution, or not low resolution, but like, you know, low polygon rocks and all these art pieces that just really don't look that nice, and all this little stuff. But they know when to use that stuff and where to use it. And it's that like combination of items that's like incredibly important. And that's something for us at Raven, like we talked about, like we would go and we would try to make every single piece look awesome. And like they show, no, like choose your A-list areas and make those look beautiful. Make sure that's the focal point for the player's screen. And you can get away with some, you know, less than awesome looking dressing or polish in some areas, and people won't notice. You know, 99% of people aren't going to see that piece, or they will notice it, but they'll immediately look back at that awesome waterfall you just built, and they're going to forget about it, and they're going to be okay with it. And like, that's really important that they just chose the right places to polish. You know, the animations of the guys matter the most. You know, not the rocks in the side of the screen.
The storytelling too. I'm curious to know what Mitch thinks about this too. But I just want to say with a quick thing that there's a scene, and I'm not giving much away here, where Nate is with this woman named Chloe, and he's, you know, sort of, that's the new romance. And suddenly Elena from the previous game pops in, right? So it's, you know, the other woman kind of thing. And how are they going to handle this? Video games like routinely screw that up. Like that's just going to be embarrassingly bad. It's going to be hackneyed. It's going to be poorly voice acted. It's going to, everything about it's going to be wrong. And it, you know, you'll play it for the dumbest joke you can find, whatever. And you know, they just nail this sort of beautiful awkwardness in that scene. And part of it's the writing, and part of it's, I call them performances. I don't know what you call these. They're performances. They look like performances to me, even though clearly there's all kind of mediation between actor and, you know, what the animators are doing. But it's beautiful. It's like, I just looked at that scene and thought, okay, here, how are they going to handle this? And I was just knocked out by how beautifully pitch perfect it was, and I didn't get whacked over the head with some stupid thing, you know?
They did perform that together, right? I mean, it was like motion capture or something. They are actually together acting in a room.
Right.
Which is not what usually happens. They didn't show up, read their lines for the first time off a sheet of paper, and then go home.
No, they do big rehearsal. Like, their whole organization is really interesting. Like, they have Amy Henning, who's the creative director, and I don't know fully how the organization works, but I believe her primary job, it handles more of the narrative side. She's there with the actors, like, on site and like, filming that while the rest of the people are building the game. So then there's, like, another creative director. I think it's a game director. I can't remember the gentleman's name. And he handles more of, like, the mechanics, I think, you know, from a high level. And, you know, in most organizations, that's just one person doing both of that stuff. And they got two people doing that. And then they have, like, two lead designers. So then they have, like, more people handling the design under that. And so they've just like found this like super, I mean, they're a super talented group of people, and they're just throwing all of their resources like wherever they need to, and like making sure there's one person just in charge of this one focused thing. And I think that really works out well for them.
Yeah. I'm doing a Q&A with her, and she's been very busy. So, you know, it's obviously going to be a fair bit after the game's been out, but that's the stuff I'm most curious about. And I think she seems willing to talk about that stuff that, like, how do you do that? Like, okay, I know that they rehearsed. I know that they had mics and they were all, you know, mo-capped. But, like, beyond that, how do you get to the point where the kinds of things that actors do spontaneously wind up in a game. That really spontaneity doesn't, that's not the first word you'd use when you think about game design, right? I mean, it's right. It's a very carefully mapped out process. Like how do you negotiate things that would happen spontaneously out of our kind of rehearsal imagination inspired kind of stuff and work with people for whom that would normally be seen as creating problems?
Well, I'll say that if there is a flaw of the game, it is that I still feel it's too heavily invested in its cinematics itself. And they're beautiful cinematics and they're well done, but at the end of the day, they're still cinematics. And I much prefer it when, like, I'm getting story. Like, I love it when I'm running alongside one of the, Chloe's, like, standing next to me, and they're having a back and forth in dialogue, but I'm doing things at the same time. I'm climbing things. Like, I feel like I'm getting story while I'm playing the game versus getting story between playing the game. Right. And so I wish, I know that's not always feasible, but I think that's more important and stronger for the medium to go with. So, the fact that they're doing all the storytelling and cinematics, I think what that means is that all the spontaneity you're talking about only affects the high level story or the intimate, like, relationship parts of the characters, but it doesn't really affect the mechanics of the game at all. So that they're divorced from each other in that respect, and that's not necessarily a good or bad thing. I mean, there's positives and negatives to both sides there, but I think Uncharted, just from a pure mechanic standpoint, with no story, would still be a very fun game, but it wouldn't be a phenomenal game. But it's that story and that those characters you care about and that love triangle you talked about. I mean, yeah, who pulls off a love triangle in a game? That's ridiculous. I would never even try. If someone came up to me and was like, this is a game we're making and you have writing a love triangle, I would say, that's a bad idea. We can't pull that off. Let's come up with a better idea about opening a vault with a key.
Yeah, I mean, they pulled off, you know, the maybe the greatest feat I've seen in a game, where they gave us female characters who had self-respect and respected one another. And I couldn't, right. You know, I've talked about this with a lot of people. That there's a scene where Chloe, right, is the...
Yes.
And when she's basically like, you can have him, I'm just getting in the way here. And some people thought that wasn't dramatic enough, but I thought that was the first time I've ever seen adults in a video game acting like adults, where they're like, you know, you get to make these decisions for yourself. I don't get to make these for you. And I thought it was a really human moment in that game, which, you know, granted, was full of them, but that was one that I don't think I've ever seen anything like it in another game before.
Yeah.
Right.
I think we've started to get seduced by the idea that video games are handling women better because they're making them more badass. You know, like, they're not just buxom victims. Now they can be badass buxom, you know, characters. And it, to me, that's hardly a step forward at all. That what you're able to see with Uncharted 2 is, you know, characters with a certain kind of three-dimensionality, and, you know, there's depth of character there, and it's, and the women behave in ways that you would expect smart people who are in control of their lives might do. Men as well, you know, it's like they're just in a situation behaving as the people, as the characters that sort of were designed into that game would behave in logical ways, and the game makes good on that. There's never a moment where you're like, he wouldn't have done that or that. I mean, the only thing for me, and this isn't about the women, it really is just about Nate. It's the only kind of dissonant thing about the game for me, and it's the disconnect between his sort of good guy persona and this desire to kind of, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to get my hands too dirty. I'd rather just go do this and then go back and have a tequila. And he becomes this maniacal killer. I mean, there's no way you can play the game. I suppose you can stealth your way through it if you really put your mind to it. But it seems to me that the way the game is built, you're just going to mow down a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's just the game. That's the nature of the story. But you know, you are this guy who is a certain guy, but you're also this guy who just kills just whale load of people.
I mean, that's a tension in a lot of action adventure stories, really. I mean, I agree. It's because they have to give you something to do in the game. It's sort of out of proportion in a video game compared to a movie. But I actually thought, you know, some of the strongest sequences in that game were ones where you're just on the defensive. There was one level in particular where a tank is hunting you through the streets.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, you get to blow it up at the end, but the bulk of the level is you're running, and it's blowing up everything around you, and it was so well done. And for the most part, you're not actually being aggressive there. You're not actually attacking very much. You're just running. And that's one of the scenes that has absolutely stuck with me.
Yeah. And you know what? Is those are the things that actually take that game and make it amazing. It's the little change-ups of things that you're doing in the game and the polish levels like we talked about. And it's not – it's the story just makes you care so much more about it. But, you know, had the gameplay not been there, this just would not been anywhere near as good. The tank sequence, the boss fight was a little weak. I'll say actually the end boss fight. I won't go into it for people who haven't gotten that far in the game. But I did find that a little weak. It wasn't as bad as the first Uncharted one, which, like, I was actually yelling at my TV when I beat Uncharted 1 because that end boss fight was awful in my personal opinion. But all those little polished things, I think what you're seeing is a game like Uncharted 2, like, you started to see it last year, but really, publishers and developers are starting to take notice now. I know this has become, like, internal conversations we've had, and I know lots of friends have had in the industry, is that, like, from a pure marketing, you want to sell your game perspective, you want to have a highly polished game. And you're seeing that being rewarded. Modern Warfare 2 is a condensed, highly polished single-player experience. And, you know, whether or not you like the whole Jerry Bruckheimer angle they took, like, you have to admire that they pulled it off for what they were trying to do. And that's why it worked. And the same thing with Arkham Asylum, in my opinion. I thought that was a really polished, simple set of mechanics that just worked phenomenally. And that's why that game is awesome. And you kind of contrast that with a Brutal Legend, which was possibly one of the games I was looking forward to most this year and was also most disappointed with. I enjoyed it, but it just wasn't – the pure mechanics weren't polished enough. And I think that's the problem that most people have seen. And when you talk about the game, you know, I talk to my buddies who are big heavy metal fans. They're like, I'm going to go play this game. Am I going to love it? I'm like, you're going to like it, but I don't know if you're going to love it for, you know, here are the things that are going to frustrate you. And then this awesome thing will happen where, you know, a mountain of skulls will be there and, you know, Jack Black will say something funny and you're going to love that. But that only lasts for 20 seconds and then you're back to, you know, 10, 15 minutes of the normal gameplay. That normal gameplay isn't polished enough to carry you through. It's not going to be a 90-plus rated game. You're not going to sell 2-3 million copies.
The interface in Uncharted 2 is so good, and I feel like people spend so much time talking about the big money moments that they don't talk about how easy this game is to play. Yeah. Which is not to say that it's an easy game to beat, but to actually pick up the controller and do what you want to do with the character is so easy. I mean, I just was playing Assassin's Creed 2 recently, and there's 4 different ways you can make your character walk. You know, and Uncharted 2 doesn't even have a run button. You run by pushing the analog stick all the way in one direction, which is the point of having an analog stick, and yet nobody does this for some reason. You know, and you even talk about you get on that train level, which is amazing, which everybody remembers. It doesn't actually give you anything new to do. You do the same basic things you've been doing the whole game. It just changes kind of the way that it happens. You know, you're still shooting, but because the train is moving and it's going up and down and going side to side, that changes what it feels like to shoot, but you don't have to learn a new way to do it. Oh. You know, and the same thing, you do climbing and platforming on the train. So that was actually the thing that I think I liked the most about this game, is that they absolutely filed down the interface until it, you know, had only the essential things they needed to do, and then they built everything out of that. You know, there's not really segments where you're learning a new game type or anything like that. You always know exactly what you're supposed to do, and there's still a challenge there, but it's not challenging because you suddenly have to learn how to play a different type of game.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see more games doing that, because Gears of War, like, I think, kind of really started that off last year really well with you're always shooting, but now you're shooting while on a Reaver or something like that. And it did that same thing where you're just doing the same thing you were always, but yet that little slight twist makes it feel new and makes the pace feel different. And that pacing is really actually, I think, the key of that game. Like that you look at, like, it's got the high points exactly when it needs to have high points, and it's not scared to have a low point or a lull in the game for a dramatic effect. Like, most games just throw guys after guy after guy after guy. And I know that's exactly what we did on Wolfenstein. Was like, there'd be an empty hallway and someone would throw a guy in there because we were scared at times, just didn't know what else to do if you had an empty hallway. And that becomes, you become slogging through guys. That was actually sometimes why I would get bored with Borderlands, is I was just doing too much of the same thing. So yeah, that pace, like, pacing things out, and you have to nail that early. Like, I can't imagine how it is to like develop that game. Then I know all games get cuts, so to have to cut pieces of your game out and still get the pacing to work perfectly has got to be just incredibly difficult. And I'm really interested to find out, you know, how they pulled that off. Like, did they have contingency plans, or were they just lucky?
It really must have taken a lot of courage to have the level late in the game where you're just walking through a village.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody loves that, right? Everybody loves that part. You love looking at it. You can kick the soccer ball to the kid. It's this nice quiet moment after all this, you know, sound and fury that has come before. And that would be such an easy thing to cut and to say, this doesn't really do anything, but it adds a whole lot. You know, really, it sort of, it shows you how much they cared about the little things they were doing in that game.
Absolutely. And I've had conversations with people, and I've heard those sorts of ideas come up and get immediately shot down. Like, that's boring. Nobody wants to do that. And that was great, is the rest of us developers can go, but Uncharted 2 did it. And we go, that was the best game of the year by a lot of people, or at least top five, in my opinion, best game of the year. How about we try it? And like, literally just being able to point to another game that did something successful, that someone pioneered the way for you, opens up the opportunities for the rest of us when maybe, you know, not everybody else is going to follow that along.
Right, right.
Hey, I'm here.
Ha-ha! Mr. Tom Bissell has joined our conversation.
I somehow forgot that Pacific was behind Eastern Standard Time. I'm not sure how I made that mistake, but I made it.
Well, welcome. It's good to have you.
Yeah, how much did I miss?
Nothing. Hardly anything.
We've been talking for an hour.
Oh, Jesus.
So let me just quickly, I know you, Manvir actually has a commitment tonight. So are you okay to stay a little bit longer, Manvir?
Oh, yeah. I got at least a half hour. We're good.
Okay. Mitch, are you okay to stay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Actually, Tom, it's not a bad transitional thing, because we were just wrapping up talking about Manvir's favorite game of the year, which he's named as Uncharted 2. And we're just kind of wrapping that up. So,
well, then I've done the perfect thing, actually.
Yes, you have. In fact, yeah. And you know, you can listen to all this later.
I have no idea what I was thinking.
Don't worry about it. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, Tom, Mitch, Manvir, hey guys.
Mitch and I have emailed once, but I've never met Manvir. Hello.
Nice to meet you, Tom.
Likewise.
Oh, yeah. Well, you've got to meet Manvir. You'll have a great time with him at GDC, I hope, when we can hang out there.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So for what it's worth, Mitch's favorite game of 2009 was Borderlands, and Manvir's is Uncharted 2, which leaves one spot open for you, Tom.
I got to say Demon's Souls.
Yes. So you've written about this. The Crispy Gamer piece, has that been published yet?
No, it will be the first piece of the new year.
Okay. So I'll reference that in advance to tell people that that's coming, because you write about that in a really interesting way. So we'll just sort of tease that a little. But tell me why that game. Why is it your favorite?
It's really not like anything else I've played in a long time. And in this piece that I wrote, I talked about how a lot of the earlier games of our youth, of my youth at least, 35, I compared them to some sort of strange lab experiment where you're, you know, given a very limited number of lives, and you're asked to just throw yourself into this completely closed, self-contained world over and over and over again, progressing a little bit further each time. And how, you know, at the time that seemed like the only model of gaming that we had. And now I compared it to, you know, pushing a lever that sometimes electrocutes you, but sometimes gives you like a little pellet, and you sort of eat it and move on. And I said, today's games kind of excrete mango ice cream and whipped nougat at very carefully spaced intervals. And that sense of desperation that you had back then. It's funny that I really didn't realize how completely we've moved away from that older methodology of game design. And so my piece basically says that while I'm really glad games have done that, a game like Demon's Souls is a really wonderful reminder of just like how deeply games can get in your head. Michael, I know you're a Demon's Souls fan, and My girlfriend basically just demanded I stop playing it, or else, you know, our relationship is over, because I was becoming such a psychotic talking about the game, and I'm like staying up at night, just like mumbling to myself about the mistake I made in the Shrine of Storms, you know, against some skeleton with an axe. I realized that the game had gotten into my mind and into my entire way of being in a way that it's just, I haven't had a game do maybe since, you know, for moments BioShock had done that, but. If you take the kind of terror of BioShock, when take away the Vita chambers, it's a completely different kind of experience, and it totally blew me away.
You used a phrase a second ago, which is interesting. You said, if I make a mistake in a certain area of the game, this is also Lee Alexander's favorite game. I did a segment with recorded a little earlier today with her, Demon Souls, and I know you know her, and she contends that part of the reason the game works so well, and I agree, is because it almost always is your fault.
Yeah,
that the game is really hard, but it's really fair. That it teaches you what you need to do, and then you have to get good at that or get strong enough. And if you aren't, or you make a misstep, or you aren't looking carefully enough, you will die, and it will be your fault.
What would you like to tell our audience about how many aggrieved emails I sent you?
I already have. Yeah. I talked about it with Lee when we were chatting about the game today. I spilled the beans that you know, Chris Dallin, who is also in another Confab segment, and I were you know, kind of nursing you through the game initially until you kind of got enough momentum going to sort of power your way through.
At the expense of my sanity, I might add.
But something kept you going. I mean, I got the very strong feeling that you were finished. I mean, that you were going to completely wash your hands with this game. And it wasn't just, I mean, it was like angry frustration. Like you were just not happy. So how did you get past that?
Well, just the worlds are so beautiful. And it really, while it is really stern and unforgiving, it also gives you these little tiny glimpses of ways to ease the difficulty. You know, it stops just short of being, you know, idiotically difficult. It kind of goes right up to the line of intolerable, and gives you very intelligently, I think, like little glimpses of, oh, maybe if I, you know, throw something or use a spell to distract that big tough guy, I can run past him here, and etc. My biggest gripe with the game is that there's no pause.
Yeah.
And yeah. I just don't understand that. I had, you know, all manner of things happen. Phones ringing, delivery men coming, you know, and that you can't pause the game when you're in the middle of some pitched battle. It's just psychotic. I mean, I have no idea why they did that. I guess it has something to do with the online capability, but.
Oh, is that? See, because I just interpreted it as, look, you're here and you're playing Demon's Souls, so don't. You know, don't go doing something else. Literally, you whatever you're doing, and if you just happen to be in a safe place, you might get lucky and you can put the controller down. But chances are, if you walk away, you'll be dead. And yeah. I think the game sort of insists on that.
I found those so-called safe places, but I kept getting invaded by people. And I swear to God, if I ever met some of those people who invaded and killed me when I had like 37,000 souls and I was right before the boss, I would murder them. I would physically harm them. Because I can't tell you how like just dispiriting and crushing it was to have gotten so far and then have some jackass come in and kill you.
Yeah,
it was, and that is an experience that, you know, I get killed over and over again in a lot of online games, and it doesn't really bother me. And that game, I really like felt despondent in a way that I don't associate with playing video games, and that was just such an interesting emotional experience. I mean, how could that not be the game of the year for me, at least?
Let me ask you this. First of all, let me check with Mitch and Manvir. Have you played this game?
No.
Okay.
I played it.
No
for
way.
Raven has a library of games, and like there was one afternoon that I popped it in and I tried to play it. It was like somebody else's saved game already on it for like an hour in, and like my buddy and I like were like, all right, I've been hearing about this game, let me try to play it. And I literally, first off, I was in some room, I guess you have like to teleport out to the actual land, something along those lines, like,
yeah,
yeah, that's right.
I literally was in that room for about 20 minutes straight because I didn't know how to get out. because like I didn't have any tutorial and I just picked up somebody else's save game. Once we figured that out and like started fighting a few guys, I got an idea for what the game was going for, but honestly, I didn't play it for long enough to get any real idea. I'm scared to play the game because of how hard I hear it is. Like, well, with all the games coming out, I was just like, I'm scared to buy this now. I'll hopefully buy it early next year.
Yeah, I think you'd be better off just picking up a heroin habit, seriously.
Well, I already have that, so... No.
Can I tell them the story of something that happens very late in the game, which is you sort of meet one non-playable character, and you know, you get one of those quote-unquote moral choices, and I did the quote-unquote right thing, and then very late in the game, he goes around and starts killing all of the merchants in the quote-unquote safe place of the game while you're gone. It's nothing you can prevent. And I came back to the safe, the Nexus, the hub area, and they were all dead. And I couldn't buy anything new. I couldn't swap out the stuff that I had. And I'm like, what the hell happened? And so after a while, I went to the Demon Souls forums, and I realized that what had happened is this person that I'd rescued killed everyone, thus trapping me with all the equipment that I had. So I wrote in my little piece about Demon Souls that it's like a move, and the game doesn't explain any of this to you, by the way. So I wrote, it's like having the credits of a movie explain to you key plot points, except the credits are in another movie. that kind of refusal to coddle, you know, our contemporary standards about difficulty in games is really weird.
Well, there's something about that game that I think horror games try to do and almost never do, and that's put you in a situation where your hands are sweating on the controller and you're like jumpy and looking over your shoulder. There are environments there which are dark enough with enough menace and enough at stake. I've talked about this before, but you know, sometimes you've got a lot of souls in your wallet and you really aren't near any safe place. And if you die, you're going to lose everything you've done.
Yeah.
And so it's this high stakes, dark, scary, and you may not know the area well, so you've got to explore it and you don't know what's around the corner. That to me is what a scary game can do. And it's not a horror game, but it's better than almost any horror game I've ever played in terms of just putting me on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, the best game of this year that I played before Demon's Souls actually came out last year. I didn't play it when it came out, but that was Dead Space, and I thought that was about as scary and putative entertainment experience as I could imagine. And if you made a game like Dead Space and imbued it with the stakes of something like Demon's Souls, I think you'd have a horror game that would have, you know, we should all invest in Depends undergarments.
So, so in the end, then, you don't feel like this is where games need to go, however.
I mean, absolutely
this is
not.
Yeah, okay. And yet you enjoy the game. I mean, you admire the game.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm just glad that the kind of median level of difficulty is, you know, maybe games are a little too easy, but if most games are like that, I would not be a gamer. I don't think that would be interesting.
What you guys don't realize about designers is that we secretly hate all of our players and that we sit in our caves with our, you know, low lighting, just laughing when people are dying.
Well, can you speak to the divide between Western and Japanese designers? Because from what I can tell from playing Japanese games, they have a completely different set of expectations, difficulty-wise.
I think Western design right now is about accessibility and bringing players along, and Japanese Japanese gaming is really about just kicking you in the balls over and over. Like, literally, that's what it feels like. It's like that classic Japanese mentality is like you learn by failure. You know, we're gonna kick you in the butt and we're gonna kick you in the butt again. And you know, come on, you have two bullets left. You can't kill the five guys with two bullets. Come on, figure it out, dude. Figure it out. That's what it feels like. I'm not a big Japanese gamer, by the way. Like, I play a lot of the Western releases. I most guaranteed will buy Demon's Souls sometime next year and play it. That will be the most, like, quote unquote Japanese game I've probably bought in a long time, because I know that game isn't very westernized at all from what I've played and heard about it. Really, it's more almost like just ported over for a Western audience and just go, versus like the Capcom games, which they really do. Capcom really works very, very hard to try to make their games appeal to the Western culture. So does Konami now. because I think they're seeing that it's not working completely for them in Japan the way they're going.
I think the Japanese-ness of Demon's Souls is that it's hard, but I think they clearly adopted a lot of Western action RPG elements into the game. It feels more like a Western style game in terms of the combat and the action in it to me, actually.
Well, all the iconography, too, is all straight out of kind of the Western tradition of fantasy.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, Tom, that you, because I know I feel very similarly. I admire authored stories. I story is always something that is a big deal to me in games and character. And this one that we both admire so much doesn't, I mean, I couldn't really even tell you the story of this. I think I could maybe, but there's not a lot that would connect you to the game in terms of storytelling. Is there here?
No, I think it just becomes the story of the game. And I'm slowly coming around to the idea that the kind of storytelling games do best is sort of where they give you a frame, a really handsome, nice, beautiful frame. And they may even give you the wire and the nail to hang it on, and maybe even the wall to put it on. But what's within the frame, the story that's going to be the most meaningful is what you put within it. And so I like the way that the story kind of makes a few feints at being sort of big and epic, but it doesn't explain all that much. And that to me is like where a lot of fantasy games just sort of collapse, is when they try to, you know, do the Tolkien number and sort of flesh out this world. But I think the world can be fleshed out just by walking through it rather than, you know, finding, you know, manuscript pages that tell you about the elders of Dayron or whatever like that.
Right.
The world's much more interesting as a living, breathing thing that is mysterious and weird and, you know, smoky and windy. And that is way, way cooler than some runic inscription that you read on a coin, you know.
Do you find the like you mentioned that little event that happens late in the game, like that would frustrate the hell out of me, that I did something to cause a consequence, which is absolutely fine. I actually think that's kind of an interesting consequence to occur, but I have no idea why it happened because the game doesn't even bother trying to tell me. Like, there's not like all they needed to do is have, like, you know, one guy in his gasping breath tells you so and so came and slaughtered everybody and then he's dead. Like, literally, that's all they would have to do to explain it so that you're like, oh crap, when I let him go, he killed everybody. And they don't even do that. And you have to go to a FAQ to find that out. Like, that to me is just too... That's not caring about your players at all. That's just, again, kicking them over and over. You had a choice, but you have no idea what the consequences are because the game doesn't manage to tell you what good or bad happened because of your choices.
Well, I should say that it is
hard but fair. That's what everybody says.
It is possible
what they say about the game sounds really unfair.
It is possible
explained in the game, and I just didn't ask the right person or talk to the right person at the right time. So
I've heard the same thing you said from other people. I've heard two other people say that they found that out from a FAQ, and that they didn't know it happened in the game. So if it was described, it certainly wasn't overt or in any way, like you said, people didn't find this. So you're not the first person I've heard say this.
Well, I'd like to ask Mitch something about the grindy elements of Borderlands, which I loved the first couple weeks I started playing it. And then I realized I was just playing it to find cool guns. And my enthusiasm for it sort of just went away after that. And yet I didn't mind collecting the souls at all, comparatively. And I'm wondering if you had a kind of grind exhaustion playing Borderlands at all.
I mean, yeah, it certainly has happened, but, you know, it's hard enough. Here's the thing about difficulty in games that I find interesting is I think it is hard enough to find time to play video games that once I start playing it, if it's actually hard to play it, I'm not that interested. I mean, I have put in something like 50 hours into Borderlands at this point, and I'm not tired of it yet. But part of the reason why is it's really not hard at all. If you die, you immediately respawn right back where you were, and if you were fighting a boss, he's got the same health. You know, so to me, it's like I keep hearing about Demon's Souls. I keep hearing how hard it is, but it's worth it, and it's fair. And I just think with the time that I have available to me to play games for fun, that would just drive me up a wall. I don't think I could take a game punishing me like that because, like I said, it's hard enough finding time to play games, don't you think?
All I can tell you is that I said exactly the same thing. Almost word for word, I said exactly the same thing. I wondered what the point was, and then, you know, partially based on Michael's advocacy, I picked it up.
I mean, and, I've certainly
I no longer feel that way.
I've enjoyed reading about it, and it sounds phenomenal. But I guarantee you that nobody would be happy if I tried to play Demon's Souls. I mean, you say it doesn't bother you to get killed in other games. It bothers me to get killed in other games. You don't want to know me. Just period. No matter how easy a game is, I'm for whatever reason I get infuriated at video games. And if I was playing one that was as hard as Demon's Souls sounds, I am pretty sure that I would have to go buy a new controller.
Hey, Mitch, did you play Assassin's Creed 2 this year?
Yes.
So what did you think about that? Because for me, I loved Assassin's Creed 2, but my biggest beef with the game was it was too easy. Like, I don't need to be kicked in the nuts over and over and over, but I want some challenge. You know, you need that fine balance, and that balance is different for everybody. And for me, Assassin's Creed didn't feel like it ever had a real challenge in it. Like, I never really fell off a building.
Yeah, which does happen. Yeah, that's kind of a good example. It's not a difficult game. There's no mission in Assassin's Creed 2 that is like, I have no idea how to do this, especially because they tell you every step of the way what you're supposed to do. But, you know, that again, that's a game that is so slow-paced that is still giving you tutorials when you're like 10 hours into it.
So true.
If that game was also hard, I don't know. I probably wouldn't have gotten out of Florence, you know?
The fact, the ease of Assassin's Creed 2, when the final boss fight is a fist fight with a fat guy.
And let me put that on your map for you to tell you where he is.
Yeah. No, I'm all for that, man. I'm all for games helping you out. I can't take this old school punishing you game design. I mean, Mega Man, what was it, 9, 10, whatever it was that came out last year, and everybody was all thrilled about it, and I said, oh, I loved Mega Man 2, one of my all-time favorite games. I'm going to play this. And I was like, oh, yeah. You know, games weren't actually fun when I was a kid. I just kept throwing myself at them because I had nothing else to do.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly true.
I do think that we've overstated the difficulty of Demon's Souls to some degree, though, that it does have a pretty high barrier to entry, I think, because for a lot of things Tom talked about, it doesn't explain much to you. But once you get about halfway through the game, and you sort of get it, and you upgrade to a certain degree, it does open up quite a bit. It's a much less difficult game in the second half than it is the first, or even the first third.
Well, I'm playing it on my second. I stopped halfway through the second playthrough because it just got, it's impossible on your second go through. You can't do it. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask each of you just real quickly before we go, and we don't even have to explore this. I'm just interested in giving people a bit of a heads up of kind of what you're thinking about for 2010. If there's a game out there on the horizon that you might be looking forward to in particular. And if there isn't one, that's fine too. But Manveer, you said you were looking at a list of games coming out in 2010.
Yeah, just the first 3 months, like the big games, Bayonetta comes out next week, I think, which looks really awesome. I played the demo, had a great time with it. Very Devil May Cry, so I'm definitely going to pick that up. I'm one of those weird people who actually enjoyed Army of Two. I know it's not a good game, but I enjoyed
that
it.
That was all right, man. That was an okay game.
I enjoyed it because I played it with a buddy, so like if I can get my buddy to buy it, I'll probably play that one too. Mass Effect 2, I think, you know, big one. The big ones for me, Bioshock 2, Splinter Cell Conviction, God of War 3. I know they're all sequels, but Splinter Cell Conviction looks like they're really changing up the stealth formula to be a lot more action-oriented, and I'm really interested how that goes down. I'm really interested in the co-op stuff that they're doing there. So I'm really excited for that game. Bioshock 2, I mean, I love the first Bioshock, you know, knowing a handful of people on that team too. Like, it sounds and looks awesome already. I'm really looking forward to that. And God of War 3, I don't understand how every single time they make a God of War game, like, it seems like half that studio leaves and they're fine. Like, Jaffe left after the first one and Corey Barlog steps in. And, you know, I know a lot of the other people were still there. And they made an awesome game again. And then Corey stepped aside and the third one just looks just as awesome. And the demo looked was awesome. So I'm just, from a pure fun, like, you know, testosterone level, God of War 3 just looks fantastic.
Cool. How about you, Mitch?
Well, yeah, I just wrote my winter preview for the Phoenix too, and just like Manveer, I mean, you look at the release schedule, it's as good as any holiday schedule would ever be, but they're all sort of known quantities, I think, which is nice. I'll play everything. I'll play all these sequels, Final Fantasy, God of War, everything. But, you know, the truth is I actually try not to pay too much attention to what is coming out because I don't like to have expectations for the things that I play. And if you had asked me this question a year ago, I definitely would not have told you that I was looking forward to playing Borderlands. I had never heard of Borderlands at this time a year ago. So that's what I'd say I'm looking forward to, is whatever's going to surprise me next year that I haven't even heard of yet.
Cool. Tom, you got one?
I am really looking forward to Mass Effect 2. I love the first game. I spent a ridiculous amount of time playing the first one. And I don't think, you know, a dude got shock, and I'm kind of concerned about the second one. I said the same thing about Left 4 Dead 2. I was really concerned that what made the first one so cool was with all the inclusions of the new elements in the second one. I kind of was worried the experience would be diluted a little bit and it would be different. It would get Resident Evil-itis, which, you know, through the process of sequel accumulation, all the stuff that made the first one so, you know, compelling and interesting gets slowly drained away from it. But to my surprise, all the new stuff I thought was just tremendously cool. So I stand corrected. But that said, a BioShock multiplayer seems to me to kind of be maybe the wrong direction for that kind of game to go. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that a game that gets all of its juice and emotional engagement from atmosphere, if you start trying to, you know, siphon that energy of atmosphere and immersion and like emotional connection, and you start trying to figure out how that works in a multiplayer world, I could be totally wrong, but I don't know. I feel like maybe that really wonderfully lonesome sense of wandering around that creepy place is going to be lost a little bit in a more sort of action-oriented game. And I know that's stupid because the first game had tons of like crazy set-piece action in it, but not set-piece so much, but just like lots of really hairy encounters. Anyone else kind of worried that BioShock 2 might sort of...
I'm worried about the multiplayer, but frankly, I don't play enough multiplayer that I'll probably check it out and I will never play it again or something. Yeah. And I think it's supposed to take place during like the Civil War itself, so it's like a different time period for the multiplayer versus the actual game. The single player.
Interesting.
So like the multiplayer is a prequel, I believe. It's like, you know, all the crazy stuff that happened that you hear about on the logs in the first game. And then there's BioShock 1, and then there's BioShock 2 single player. I believe that's what it is.
Well, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think according to Steve Gaynor, they've obviously it's off to certification now, so they're pretty much done with it, and you know, it's in those final stages that you kind of like figuring out why there needed to be a second game was the biggest challenge, that and convincing gamers that like it, the first game seems so self-contained. It seems such a kind of a perfectly beginning, middle, and end kind of game. Why would you need a second one? And I think that internally, of course, he won't say why or what this means, but internally, once they licked that, you know, they had a sense of, oh, okay, this is why this makes sense. Then it was kind of full steam ahead. And I'm just curious to know what that hook is or what that thing is that makes the second game feel necessary.
Well, we all know what the second game is necessary, and it's money. I mean, I mean, that's what it comes down to. You cannot sell a major IP to a developer and go, we're only going to make one of these. Like, or like, no publisher will ever pick your game up. You have to be all about, well, here's how, that's why you hear all these trilogies, Mass Effect's a trilogy, Too Human or whatever was supposed to be a trilogy. Okay. You know, that's why everyone's doing that, is because it's how you get your game signed and say, this is how we're going to monetize our game over the next 10 years. It's unfortunate because sometimes it goes against the creative aspect. And I think that's the that fight between commercialism versus artistic integrity that any mainstream media gets. You know, like Hollywood film has the same problem. Like Die Hard 1 could have just stopped, but, you know, they made Die Hard 4. I don't know why, but they did. And it's not like an art, quote unquote, art movie, but it's still a really awesome action movie that could have just stood on its own. So, Michael, I have a question for you. Yeah. Are you looking forward to No More Heroes 2? Cause,
oh, totally I am. Oh, absolutely.
So I really enjoyed the first one. I hated the open world stuff, but the actual levels themselves were phenomenal. Like just the style and the zany and the attitude that Grasshopper has with that game. And I didn't even realize it was coming out, like, January 26th, I think, is coming out.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That's a game, again, it doesn't feel like it needed a sequel. And in fact, if you got the proper ending, I don't even know how they're having a sequel.
Yeah, I just love crawling into Suda's head, you know? That, to me, that's what every one of those games is about. And so far, he just makes it worth it for me to do that. And I just don't ask any questions. I mean, he makes it worth it to me. And that you kind of have to put up with some stuff, you know?
Yeah.
They're really messy in some ways. I just hope that there's always room for a guy like him to make games like that. That sometimes they just don't make sense. They're very personal. They have, you know, there's a strain of humor that runs through them with sort of scatological stuff that's just... It just seems like he just wants to do it, and so nobody says no to him, so it's in there. And I don't know. I guess I'm enough of a fan of auteurism to think that it's cool that there's a designer out there that brings us a game like that, and that I'm looking forward to seeing what he's pulling up out of his sleeve this time.
I'm totally with you. It's a day one buy for me. It actually comes out the same day as Mass Effect 2, which will make things interesting, but I'll figure out how to play both. But yeah, it just totally wasn't on my radar, and then when I started looking at it, I'm like, that's cool, but I wasn't as excited as I thought I would be, having really enjoyed the first game. I don't. Maybe it's the same thing that Tom's talking about with BioShock 2, where it's just like there's something just holding you back. You go, awesome, but do I need this?
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. I appreciate your time, and I'm really glad that you were able to jump in here, Tom. we were able to include you in the podcast with hardly a beat skipped. So
yeah, I appreciate it. I just don't know what I was thinking.
Don't worry about it. Yeah. Don't worry about it. I'm just glad to have you aboard the Gamers Confab. You're a first-time guest, and it's always a thrill to talk to you in person or via Skype. Thanks very much, and Happy New Year to all of you, and happy gaming.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.